Okay, let me welcome you all to this debate on the subject in defense of globalization. I'm Tony Venables, Professor of Economics in the LSE, who's chairing the proceedings. Obviously, it's a great pleasure and an honor to welcome Jagdish Bhagwati to the school for this event. His name is clearly known to all of you. He's one of the most distinguished people in the area of international economics. He's had a long and distinguished academic career, holding academic positions in India, at MIT, at the University of Columbia. Looking up his CV, the grand total is something over 300 articles, 45 volumes of written works, so an enormously impressive total. He's someone who's really been a dominant figure, one of the great dominant figures in international economics and economics more widely, certainly for as long as I've been in the subject. Contributions include founding the Journal of International Economics, numerous honorary degrees from universities around the world. But in addition, of course, his work, his contribution, extends beyond just writing those 300 articles and 45 books. He's worked extensively with international organizations, advising the GATT, the WTO, the United Nations. He's worked with NGOs, so he's on an advisory board for Human Rights Watch, and as well as several other NGOs. And of course, he has a great reputation as a writer, a disseminator of ideas. He's won awards for his economic writing, taking the issues that he passionately believes in and disseminating the ideas, making them accessible, and opening up the debate. I'm sure we're going to see those skills today, and certainly for those of you who read his book, which I hasten to add is on sale outside, you will see these dissemination skills. It's described on the back cover as witty and erudite. And for once, the back cover is dead right. It really is witty and erudite. Let me add a small sort of personal note to having Jagdish here. I'm afraid that I was reading a small book that he wrote in the 1960s, The Economics of Underdeveloped Countries, that has to take some of the responsibility for turning me onto economics in the first place. So certainly I feel a sort of personal debt to Jagdish for that. Okay, well, the format today is going to be debate, or discussion, I think is the better term, with me chairing, between Jagdish and Saskia Sassen. Now, Saskia is very kindly standing in at the last moment for Richard Sennett, who was going to do this, but was taken ill. So Saskia herself is, of course, an enormously distinguished academic, probably best known for her work on cities. A book, Global Cities, which is very widely read, translated, and much cited. She's currently a professor at the University of Chicago and a visiting centennial professor at the school, but also has a big interest in issues of globalization, and indeed has a forthcoming book, the title of which you can see I'm struggling for here, the title of which is Denationalization, Territory Authority and Rights in the Global Digital Age. So again, an expert on globalization and some of the issues that it raises. As I've said, the format for the debate, the conversation, is informal. Indeed, I think I'm supposed to be sitting in a soft chair, as the main contributors are supposed to be sitting in soft chairs for the duration. I'm going to invite Jagdish, obviously, to make some preliminary remarks about his motivation for writing the book and some of the main messages from the book. And then we're going to try and steer an informal discussion between the two protagonists. There will be time for questions at the end, probably 20 minutes or so at the end, and then we'll finish promptly at 1:45. But with that, let me invite Jagdish to make some opening remarks.
Go there, or here, from here?
Wherever you're more comfortable, from there.
This probably makes more sense, right? So they can see us as a group.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Tony, for those excessively generous remarks. I mean, it's customary when somebody makes those kinds of remarks to say, oh, my, you know, my mother would have loved them, but, you know, I really am embarrassed by them. When I was saying that privately after such an introduction, my wife, who can match me in my whatever wit I possess, she said, oh, but, you know, there's nothing that you said, she said to this guy, which my husband doesn't say better about himself. Thank you again, in any case, and I'm delighted that Saskia is here. I've known her for many, many years, and she's a wonderful intellectual. Aside from being an expert on immigration issues, she's much greater breadth, which you'll doubtless you'll observe. Many people ask me why I wrote this book, and you know, Professor Venable said, you know, to say, begin with that. And of course they say, is it a response to my wonderful new colleague, Professor Stiglitz, whose book doubtless you've seen and maybe even, purchased. Well, it's exogenous to Stiglitz, actually. I've been thinking about these issues ever since Seattle, if not earlier. But I must tell you a story that when I was in Mexico recently, where they're having a debate, as most places have, about globalization and its benefits or its alleged excesses and harms and so on. And there, somebody told me, one of my many students there, said that Professor Stiglitz had been through here. So is that why you're here? So I said, well, when I was a young person, like most of you here, Joan Robinson, who was my great radical teacher in Cambridge, whenever Milton Friedman went around Indian universities lecturing, Joan would reproduce the entire itinerary, going around a few weeks later and undoing the damage. So I said, well, I didn't even know Joe Stiglitz had been here, but since I'm here, I will take the occasion to undo the damage. Now, when you look at globalization, which is really the big issue, I think, of our time right now, and you see, when you work with NGOs and you see them in the, you know, the civil society or sometimes uncivil society, and you see them agitated about these globalization issues, and by that I mean economic globalization. One could talk about students going across countries, and that's also part of globalization. I don't want to spread it that big, but you talk about trade, multinationals or direct foreign investment, as we call it in jargon, short-term capital flows, immigration issues, technology, which is all related to intellectual property, rights, and so on. All of these dimensions on which countries interact in the world economy, and where integration has been proceeding apace, particularly in the last 50 years, is this something which is basically harmful to a variety of things we are concerned with? Or is it, on balance, a good thing? I mean, that is the big issue. Now, when the NGOs are coming at it, and a whole lot of other people, I mean, students are not NGOs. I mean, I consider myself to be a one-person NGO. Though my wife corrects me and says I'm a one-person NG disorg. But basically, we are all intellectuals and participating in this process insofar as we do interact with these issues. The concern is the many fears that really it's a harmful process, but not on economic grounds, because on the economic grounds, we have endless debates, like, you know, in Professor Venable's class, if I was lecturing there, I mean, or giving a seminar, we'd be discussing arguments like, is free trade on, you know, on what grounds is it better than protection, for example? And those are technical subjects, and in every generation, there are two or three people who go to the other side, and you know, if I was talking about trade, which I don't plan to particularly, I would say yes. I mean, those are issues which are very much like Vatican debates among different cardinals, for example. They're doctrinal debates, and they're very important actually, because economic prosperity is not something to be sneezed at, and it's very much tied into the other issues which I want to talk about. But that is basically something where we can sort it out among ourselves. I don't think the many civil society groups, etc., encounter, debate with, and so on, and work with, are worried about that particularly. They leave it to the economists. And so I can take on Joe Stiglitz, no contest on this issue, or Danny Roderick, you know. I mean, I call them respectively the Danny Roderick, I call the Osama bin Laden with his Al-Qaeda network. And I tell Joe not to use his Nobel Prize as a weapon of mass destruction. But you know, those are debates which are interesting for students to have, I mean, to know what it is. But I think the common concern is what I call, what might be called social implications, which we as citizens are worried about particularly, like the effect on gender issues, the effect of globalization, the effect of globalization on the environment, the effect on poverty, the effect on our, in the Western countries, the developed countries, on our real wages of our workers, the sort of thing which is now coming up at a higher level of skills for on outsourcing, which is a huge debate in America today. But that has to do with income distribution in some sense, or specific distributional issues. Labor standards, you know, our unions have fought for them for over a century. Are we now going to have them undermined simply because of the integration of the world economy? And, you know, people go and tell people, workers, you know, unless you accept lower wages, that's the ethos which we encounter. I'm going to go off to Malaysia, you know. And, you know, one's first reaction would be say, yes, go there, you know, I mean, you'll come back soon, you know. But it's really, that's the kind of talk which people indulge in. And a lot of people believe that, and that there are labor standards are at stake, and the unions are therefore exercised over it. Child labor, is it accentuated or helped? Now, when I was working with the United Nations for 1 year, I started reading a lot of reports, and because I was supposed to be working on globalization. And I must have been appointed by mistake, obviously, because every report that I read was, here is all these evils on all these dimensions, and here is globalization. Therefore, globalization is the cause of the latter. And my first reaction was like Tina Turner's song, which, you know, what's love got to do with it? And I said to Kofi Annan and others, you know, what has globalization got to do with it? And the question which we as intellectuals have to ask is globalization better or worse at the margin? Because these are evils, these are things, you know, causes which we have to embrace, and where are we at on this? So that is a sort of background to it, because there was an easy assumption, or let me say fear, that really globalization was part of it. I mean, even when globalization wasn't directly produced as a cause, I would read things like, in a globalized economy, this is happening. So there was an implicit attack on globalization. So I decided to really work through, well, the claims of the civil society and try and find out, you know, what exactly they were bothered about, what were the specific arguments and so on. So I didn't want to construct straw men or Aunt Sally's, depending on your gender preference. And really, I wanted to see what exactly was where they were coming from and whether there was any sense in it. And to bring to bear whatever knowledge, you know, a priori arguments, econometric evidence, etc., which we have on a variety of these issues. And that's the background. Now, I think we can transact with civil society on these dimensions because I've worked with them, and I do think if we do bring knowledge such as we have, or which we can, then we can actually dialogue with them. But two kinds of claimants among the stake, they call themselves stakeholders, and it's not a, I mean, one, I think one group is, are people who want to wield stakes like in Dracula films, you know, where you drive it through the system. Well, I mean, in the book, I explore where they're coming from. I don't think you can transact with them in the sense in which I'm discussing, like, you know, what is it that bugs you? What's it that ails you? Because if you try and do that, if you try and extend a hand to them, they'll bite it, not take it, you know, and so on. And it's interesting to know where they're coming from. And some of them go off now, have their own playground, Porto Alegre and so on, in Bombay recently. But there are some good people also who go there from the second lot. And the second lot are those who have, you know, want to sit down with you and say, look, I don't think the globalization process is a good one, you know, and on the diamond. So those dimensions are really the ones which I got from those people. And we can go down the line, but essentially, I argue, let me just say gender issues, for instance. There's a long chapter on gender issues. And I just say, look, I mean, take gender equality. Lots of ways to define it, but take it in the narrowest sense and say equal pay for Professor Sasson and me if we are in the same department and we're equally distinguished. I know I'm demeaning her because she's more distinguished than myself. But let's pretend she was equally distinguished, if not more so. And then she's getting one-third the pay or, you know, one-half the pay or maybe two-thirds the pay. That's gender inequality at the same place, okay? Now, what is happening to that to that inequality? Well, there is this beautiful paper by Larry Katz's students at Harvard, two PhD, who are now working at Williams College and Federal Reserve in New York, Elizabeth Brainerd and Sandra Black. And they go by the Becker hypothesis that every prejudice carries a price, all right? So in internationally traded industries, globalization, okay? In internationally traded industries, the pressure of competition is so fierce that you would expect that men would not be paid more wages than equally qualified women because that costs something. And if it costs something, you're then not going to be able to sustain that. So the demand for people like me will fall off, and the demand for people like Saskia Sassen will go up, narrowing the wage differential, essentially. And they find over a 20-year period, as the gender pay inequality declines for other reasons, it goes faster in traded industries than in non-traded. Surprise, surprise, okay? But this is what you would expect, but it's good to find things that you do expect, you know, in the world. So this is absurd blown. A more general kind of thing, you take Japan, which produced the greatest novelist in the 12th century, you know, whom doubtless many of you have read, something went wrong later. And now Japan today treats its women almost even today also, very differently from the way advanced countries do. I mean, it's almost medieval, feudal. What's happening there? With globalization, when in the 80s, when the Japanese multinationals went out abroad, what happened with them? Of course, only the men were the executives, because women generally bring tea or stay in the house and so on and have very traditional roles. But when they went out and then saw, the wives went with the husbands, and then they lived in New York and Paris and London and so on, and they saw how women were being treated, what rights they had, you know, and so on. And that changed. That was really a very seditious thing. When they went back, they became agents of social change in a very big way. So Japan is also changing now very fast, not as fast as one would wish, but that's another way in which globalization is actually helped. So one can go, so this is the kind of evidence that I produce. So I conclude, basically, in the language which we use in the political space, particularly with your prime minister and Gerhard Schroeder and Bill Clinton and so on, they're the aficionados of the third way, as you know, the social democrats, who are moving a little bit to the center. And so they talk about globalization needing a human face, and by which mean they must mean they lack it lacks one, okay? Which means on these social dimensions, that's all I can interpret them as saying, that on the social dimensions, globalization needs to be fixed, right? That it's really producing adverse rather than helpful outcomes at the margin. In contrast to that, I conclude that globalization has a human face simply because on all these dimensions I find that on balance it's a positive force, not a negative force. But if I do that, the nature of intervention changes completely because you have to have appropriate governance, institutions and policies, domestic and international. And if you, let me illustrate with child labor. If I think child labor is going to be worsening as a result of intervention, by the state, as a result of prosperity brought about by globalization, that when parents earn more income by exporting rice, which they couldn't before in Vietnam, for which there are studies, they will in fact say, oh, hooray, you know, I can send one more child to work and take the child off school because I'm going to get more money. So the income effect goes in the direction of wickedness and towards children. On the other hand, The parents may react by taking children off work and put them into schools because now they're less impoverished. And there are a variety of arguments like credit constraints and so on. So there are econometrics, you know, that parents are able to earn the rate of return on investment in children if they break a credit constraint. You know, that's the sort of the argument we have in the literature. But there are many studies which show that actually child labor reduces at the margin as prosperity breaks out, and if globalization adds to the prosperity, another theme which I also have in the book, then that is a good thing, right? Now, if you believe child labor is really getting worse as a result of globalization, what would you do? You would throw a little sand into the gears, and if you belong to the stake wielders, you know, you would throw the sand into the engine and try and bring it to a halt. But otherwise, you get a trade-off between increased income and increased and reduced child labor. I mean, you have to choose, so there'll be some optimum in between, depending on your social welfare function. But if you think child labor is going to diminish, then what would you think about? You would say, except for some friends I can do without, that look, that's fine, we don't need to do anything more. I would say, no, we want to enhance, accelerate the speed at which we go. Because even today, I mean, even on growth, we say, we're not content with the miraculous Meiji restoration rate of growth of Japan of 2%. Today, if you don't have 6%, you say you're a failure, right, in the developing countries. So we've learned to accelerate the growth rate. We have to learn to accelerate the social agendas also. So I would like to think of what are the techniques by which I can push this ahead. Or to put it differently, like if a woman is being beaten up by her husband, and she says, help, help, you don't go in there and say, look, wow, hang in there for 25 years, economic growth will take care of you. I mean, you want to go in and nail that bastard to the wall right away. And the interesting question is, what is a counterpart of that, nailing that bastard to the wall, as far as all these agendas are concerned? And that's a real issue. How do you do that? And like with a lot of these labor standards issues, the unions automatically assume that all you can do is have trade sanctions to do it. And I argue in the book that that's very counterproductive for a variety of reasons. And I say, look, and then they say, look, WTO has teeth and ILO has no teeth. And I say, God gave us also a tongue. And a good tongue lashing and in the age of CNN, NGOs, democracy, and so on, can be much more productive moral suasion than sanctions which, coming from imperfect, flawed governments, necessarily flawed governments, can actually put your backs up, and people may actually not even do things which they would otherwise do under their own steam. So there are a variety of arguments, but those are appropriate design governance questions. How do we do this? And those are things where we can bring our insights to bear and our thinking to bear. And the other thing, of course, is the how to handle downsides, because we can only talk in economics about central tendencies. Right, when I say globalization on balance, if you've noticed, is good rather than bad, that is, there's still going to be occasional reverses, specific parametric situations where it won't work. In that case, you have to really worry about how do you handle it institutionally. You can't just say by and large, more or less, you know, that's the version of economics which is called by and large economics, that, you know, by and large things will work out, in the long run things will work out. You've got to treat these problems here and now to handle, you know, the occasional downturns. That's the institutional issue. Now, if you look at, just take the one final economics example, you take adjustment assistance, which is what European countries have, and this is what people are discussing in relation to outsourcing, how to help these semi-skilled computer programmers and so on to handle the outsourcing of, you know, of the online services and so on. How do you help them move to other occupations? So the continuously with every trade expansion act in the United States, ever since President Kennedy's time, we've had every such act, and that comes on every 2 or 3 years, carry an adjustment assistance program to ease the import competing workers who may be losing jobs to transit to the other jobs which are coming up on the export side and so on. Now that we have persuaded the developing countries to go ahead and start doing it, you know, and give up their earlier protection, many developing countries simply don't have the institutions like adjustment assistance programs, largely because they don't have any money. And it can be very expensive to both, and it can be hard to design these things. We are still experimenting with the best ways to do it in the West. So where do you get the money from? So I would say, look, I mean, sort of President Wolfensohn of the World Bank, who acts very much like Evita Peron, throwing money in all directions, your money probably, I don't know where how to assign the incidence of what their money they spend, but having no sense of priority, because if you say everything matters, then nothing matters, right? But so you have to have a sense of priority. The bank is into globalization. They have the money. They should have produced these programs and so on. So I've been bugging him for a long time in public, and I'm told he's got, you know, he's not very happy with me. And I wouldn't be happy with myself if I was in his position, because I've been saying things. But finally, about a month ago in the Financial Times, he and Kohler of the IMF said that they were going to do something, and Wolfensohn is going to now start doing it. Maybe, you know, it should, if it was done when Professor Venables was, it would have been done efficiently, but now it'll be done somehow. No, less well, but it'll be done. But that's the kind of thing we have to think about, because we do not think sufficiently about how to handle these down. So then people say, look, we don't want trade liberalization, right? Because, you know, President Kennedy couldn't have gotten the Kennedy round going if he hadn't struck that deal with George Meany of the AFL-CIO to get the adjustment assistance program. So how are we going to do that in our developing countries where the resources of people are much more limited, people are closer to famished conditions and so on? And the last thing is to avoid, I think, excessive speed to the transiting to the outside, you know, to international integration. And that, I mean, the financial crisis showed, in my opinion, if anything, that it was imprudent to go too fast without fixing up your banking system and so on. And I think today everybody recognizes that, though they may not admit it in public. That was a case where the speed was excessive. And so I think we have to worry about the political and economic dimensions of the speed at which we transit. I mean, my other colleague, Jeffrey Sachs, sort of brought shock therapy to Russia and left it in shock. And, you know, I mean, we shouldn't become, I mean, the maximal speed is not the optimal speed. You have to put it into the local context. And I think economists sometimes have a technocratic tendency, particularly if they're advising foreign governments. I mean, all the problems you recognize at home somehow seem to disappear, and then you say you're not moving fast enough. And I think we have to, I mean, all the great economists whom I cite in the book, Keynes, Adam Smith, they're all for gradualism on these kinds of grounds. And it's only the young technocratic types who become foreign advisors who push people in the wrong direction. Sometimes you need to put a spine on people, you know, when they don't have it. Like Professor Sachs's role in Poland was not to invent shock therapy, but to convince Balcerowicz that it was worth going through with it. It worked in Poland for very special reasons. Then applied to Russia, it produced a disaster, in my view, and that of many people. Maybe not as much of a disaster as we think, but it certainly did. And my comment on that was that, you know, Russia, having devastated Poland over centuries, finally wreaked its revenge on Russia through courtesy of my new colleague, Jeffrey Sachs. And so maybe there was sweet irony here. But I think the lesson to be drawn is simply that, you know, we have to be broader than just pure economics and say, look, how do we put this into the political and economic framework? Because otherwise, if you try and open a door too fast, it may rebound shut, and it might be better to go gently with pressure. So this is a case where, well, the social agenda should be implemented faster. The reforms which you often, you know, push, I think we ought to be a little more cautious. There I'm putting the opposite thing. So I think the appropriate governance goes with the view you have of globalization. So I think that is really what the book is about. I'm sorry it's a long answer, but just puts the things on the table.
Excellent. Well, thank you. That certainly sets the stage. I think there are a number of issues we want to pursue in more detail on this, and clearly Saskia has no doubt itching to say things. I think perhaps the first issue to pursue a bit more is the idea that you do sometimes hear that there's something something in globalization that inherently is inequality increasing within countries, between countries, across regions of countries, an argument that's sometimes put forward. I don't know if... Yeah. Let's take that as the first
sure, I think it's a good set of issues to pursue
a bit more.
I mean, I would like to start with...
on another issue.
No, I will get to that issue. That's a very important issue. But Jagdish, who is also actually a dear friend, we have had dinners together, very good dinners, actually.
At your house.
At your house, they were pretty good, too. I find the account that you now present very intelligent, very well-reasoned, and very broad. There are lots of open doors for many people with many different views and many different bags of data to walk in and have a conversation with you. In the end, you wind up with a very strong defining moment, which is in defense of globalization. And I must tell you, Jagdish, as I was reading the book, you make that case even more strongly, I would say, than you made it right now. And the book is out there, as we have mentioned. You know, the evidence is on the table, so to speak. And the Jesuits, you know, the good old Jesuits, they developed a famous model, casuistics, to make the case of the case. Jagdish, I know you're no Jesuit, all right? You are not a Jesuit.
I went to a Jesuit school.
Oh, you did? Oh, well, I did not know that.
Maybe I was because converted subliminally.
There is a bit of that in the structuring of the arguments. And of course, the data is incomplete. Of course, we're dealing with a messy, thick environment. Where does the global begin? Where does it end? Where does the non-global interfere? So the question that I have for you is really as follows. We have had 20 years of globalization. It's very different to have this title and this position. It's not just a question of a title. You know, the editor may have wanted that title. But to have this position 20 years since, you know, it all sort of began to really shape up, than to have had it even 10 years ago. So that's a very strong claim. And I think in the book you develop that claim. And so I have a couple of questions to you. The first one is, one of the outcomes of whatever the combined efforts, mind you, of corporate elites, brilliant accountants, very creative types, right? Brilliant lawyers, and governments, because that is part of the story, that national governments have put out some of their best people to, you know, reinvent some of their policies on finance, on investment, on privatization, etc. The new technologies, the vast amounts of capital that we can mobilize, because finance, after all, makes money. It's not just about managing money. It makes money. It invents ways of creating money. That we wind up in the place where we are at. At that point, see, I can agree with a lot of the points that you make, even though there is a bit of casuistics in many of the cases that you used to illustrate. You're partly bound up, you know, by the existing evidence. But I must say, I would wind up in a different place. I would say that defending globalization is not necessarily what we should be doing right now. Now, I am, you know, I think of globalization as very complex. I'm not against globalization the way I'm against what global finance is able to do. I have serious problems. I'm against unfree trade. Right? If we only had real free trade, but there is too much stuff in there that makes it less free, etc. But I must say, so even I'm not simply anti-globalization. I think that on the issues of some of the social issues, a lot of new energies, new actors have emerged where once national states and corporate elites were the only actors. Now we have NGOs, we have worlds of other actors, actually. But I think that far too little has been accomplished. And far too much damage has also been produced. And so that moves me then. So the first question would be to you, is it enough with those many resources, capabilities, and positive dispositions on the part of whole, you know, worlds of governments, right, to, okay, let's give this a try. Is it enough to wind up where we're at, where we have massive indebtedness not resolved in so many countries? We have prosperity, we have economic growth, But, you know, we need to disaggregate that. We know, you know that better than I do. We can't just say because there has been growth that the distributive issues. And secondly, I would say as a footnote, you know, in the 60s, you had economic growth indicators that actually signaled the growth of middle sectors, of highly standardized sectors. Today, that same indicator can signal a very different type of distribution. You know, high, you know, income professionals grow, and so do a lot of low. So all these issues. So my question to you is this really enough? The second question, because it comes out of an important point that you make, which is that, my God, globalization has brought prosperity. Globalization has cleaned up a few very corrupt governments, right? It has, I mean, you know, transparency rules, though one asks for whom, the transparency. I mean, it's ultimately a lot of it is for investors so that they know what they're getting into, right? And that certainly can be good. You know? But the time A, time B question, you know, that you say, look, we have had prosperity, we have had growth, and somehow globalization is in. I also worry about that time A, time B framing. I am not so certain that we can generalize. I think we've had certain kinds of growth, enormous kinds of dynamism in places that may have gone a bit stagnant. I see that in the 40 global cities that I see around the world, a lot of dynamism. But to infer from that somehow the global economic system has delivered the goods, again, I find a bit problematic. So inequality is one of the issues hanging in there. But I think there is a broader issue of where do you position yourself vis-a-vis these 20 years of history, given the enormous capabilities. And at that point, I think we might have a disagreement, you know, that would make it very difficult for me to say in defense of globalization. And then I want to move on to trade issue, but that's for later.
But given your doubts on globalization, I think that's an adequate title. In fact, the earlier title was A False Alarm, which I was alarmed about. so this is, but in fact, it is exactly taking on your kinds of worries. And I think going back to, I mean, you overlapped with Tony and the book. In fact, I began, you know, my statement by saying, economic prosperity is an internal debate among economists, and that these are there are other issues which are really people are concerned about. So, and that's, you know, we're all in agreement on that. So the book does deal with exactly, I mean, also things, this whole chapter on poverty. So let me just tell you what my view on poverty is. I mean, I come from a country where India, even the United States for that matter, where there is considerable inequality, okay? But the poverty is particularly offensive in a country like the United States, which is fairly rich, but it's offensive anywhere. And as I was growing up, poverty was the thing I was really worried about. And in fact, when I went back to India from education abroad, the first thing I was doing with the Indian Planning Commission was to, I was asked to devise policies, which for a young person returning from Cambridge was not exactly a possible task, but how to bring up the bottom 30% to respectable living standards. So that poverty was the issue, absolutely, you know, which the at least countries like India were seized with at that point, I'm talking of 61, 62, 63. Inequality, that is my good friend Amartya Sen's main preoccupation. But I don't think that is, I mean, I think it has to be put into sociological terms, which is on your side of the street. I mean, if you go around measuring Gini coefficients or whatever, it's okay. But these are theoretical constructs which we make up in the classroom and we're all agitated about it. But when you go into the real world, you have to say, look, does it matter? I live in Columbia University, and when I look behind me, it's Harlem, real poverty. And I go look the other way, it's Wall Street, Park Avenue, with people like Soros's and Rubens, with enormous, unspeakable wealth, right? Uncountable wealth in many cases. Supposing if their income rises by 5%, which it frequently does in a year, automatically the people at the bottom in Harlem are getting less than the total income. So, and the top 5% are getting more. Has it had any sociological impact? I don't know. But that's where we have to begin. Maybe people in Harlem are sufficiently part of the system that they really think that maybe the size of the lottery ticket has gone up if these people are earning more because they aspire to the American dream. That is something you have to take into account. Or if wealth is spent, like your Dutch ancestors, you know, in Simon Sharma's book on the embarrassment of riches, if it's spent in an unostentatious way and is plowed back into society, that also makes inequality and capitalism bearable. But if you flaunt it, then it's going to, like in Russia today.
I think
what I'm going to say is that inequality, I find it harder to deal with at a general level. I think it's specific to societies.
Sure.
But poverty, I think, is something we, you know, even though that in turn, of course, depends on inequality, theoretically. But large, by and large, you can say I want to bring people up to reasonable standards of living. There, so that's what I sort of mainly concentrate on for the reason that I explained. If you take the two very biggest countries, India and China, which specialize in poverty, huge amounts of poverty, unfortunately, their growth has been the principal instrument for attacking it. Kaleski, the great Polish economist who almost anticipated Keynes, when he came to India, and I was, you know, a young professor of 29 at that time, and he employed me immediately as a research assistant because I looked young, forced me to work for him, which was a pleasure. You know, he was a great man. And he said, Bhagwati, the problem in your country is that there are too many exploited and too few exploiters. All he was saying was that to have a sustainable impact on poverty, it wasn't sufficient to redistribute income. You had to grow the pie, as the Americans put it. That is really what a lot of studies have subsequently found. And in India and China, we have no time to discuss that here, until the early 80s, when for different reasons, they were both inward-looking autarkic countries, one for political and the other by choice, we had very slow growth rates. And poverty really wasn't indented in a big way, certainly not in India. After that, for different reasons, they took off, became outward-oriented, became less fearful of global integration. Then, I'm not saying they ripped open markets and but they moved in the direction of exploiting the international opportunities rather than shrinking from.
Yeah.
Then you have enormous impact on poverty in both countries. So I would say that exactly on the thing you're worried about, poverty, inequality, I said, depends on the country.
I
do think that it really does make a difference.
Yes.
Positive difference.
Yes. However, look at the framings that you have. You know, you keep pulling out of this global era, Simon Sharma's embarrassment of riches, your Indian governor, the Chinese. But the point here is that, two points I want to make very quickly on these kinds of issues. One is that we have quite a bit of evidence that documents that with all the capabilities, with all the promises, let's remember the rhetorics 10 years ago, right? 91, right? Free markets, that we have failed to eliminate massive kinds of poverty that in principle could have been in this very global era. Secondly, and this is really what I want to get at, because I want to get into the fabric of the argument as you develop it in the book. So yes, export processing zones, multinationals, they come, they bring jobs. And right, the evidence shows that they pay a bit more. I'm talking now, you know, multinationals working in low-wage countries, right? Because Jagdish does address that, and he does try to get a handle on what the literature says, and you cite the studies, etc. And the literature indeed shows that when these multinationals go, they pay more than the average schlep down the corner who pays even less. Now, there is a question of gradation, right? So the fact, you make a big deal in the book about the fact that foreign firms, i.e. globalization, pay a premium wage, actually. Now, what is left out, this is what I mean by casuistics, rejected. Well, and I am really stunned that you actually went to a Jesuit school, I must say. This is not, this is very interesting to me. So you look at that evidence, right?
You can write a book on psychoanalysis.
Where is the story coming from? Here is the story that is left out of the picture. Because I, of course, have also dealt with that subject. Wow. And I've looked at ethnographic studies, at anthropologists' sort of literature. There are two bits that are left out of the story. One bit is that many of these workers get used up very fast. If they are working on electronic stuff, you know, the fumes from, they get blinded. By 25, many of these workers, yes, they've had a premium wage, they're used up. And where do they wind? They conveniently, vis-a-vis the statistics or the data gathered by economists, disappear in the thickets of informal economies. So they don't even show up on the radar screen that would allow you a more longitudinal analysis. Well, what happens to these workers? But then there is a deeper structural issue that I have been deeply concerned with. And that is a multinational comes in, brings in a factory, brings in a service operation, a restaurant, chain, whatever. They are more efficient, they move fast, et cetera, they pay premium wages. But what do they also do is they destroy, they destabilize, they reduce these rather inefficient, more traditional economies that involved a lot of local mom-and-pop restaurants and a little factory here. Yes, inefficient, but I don't want to make a god out of efficiency. But those function, those inefficient, more traditional economies function like sticky webs, which allowed all kinds of quite marginal actors to hang in there. And so there is quite a bit of evidence that shows that as this modernization moves in with global firms setting up factories, yes, growing jobs, you see growth in jobs, you see growth in wages, but the cost to these economies has been huge. And this is now, this started in the 60s, mind you, but it has now, of course, grown in the 90s very, very strongly, so that the overall effect cannot be captured by what you do in the book, which is the simple measure of the wage premium. They pay actually better wages. And you even look, because subcontracting is the other issue, you know, so these big multinationals on their site, they may pay better wages, but the other argument has been by critics, the subcontractors, you know, they are super exploiting, they are doing the worst dirt, so to say, for the multinationals. And you very persuasively show that not even that is the case. So there one might, the data is very problematic. But even if you accepted your argument also on the subcontractors, I think that this, the framing, the time framing is very problematic to me. And so so this is one sort of the issues about this kind of globalization where the measures that we use camouflage a deeper structural condition which in a longer time frame for that country that is stuck with that condition can actually be quite negative. And I would argue that we have quite a bit of data that suggests that one of the reasons that globalization hasn't been this miracle that it has with all the capabilities, the money, the investment, the new jobs, is because of these huge shadow effects that have not been so positive. You don't have to agree with me, Jagdish. I was just saying that this is part.
I will try very hard to agree with you, Saskia. No, I have read some studies, you know, and maybe I've missed a few on the anthropological side as well. I mean, the focus on just the what Professor Sazen said about exploitation, that comes out of the anti-sweatshop movement and so on. So those are part of the concerns. And what I do is to examine that argument, saying, does it make sense to say that our workers in the poor countries are being exploited in the sense that we are paying them low wages? And I simply point out that there is a wage premium which is actually to be found on the average in terms of what the multinationals pay. And on subcontracting, that essentially there's no evidence that subcontractors are paying, of the multinationals, are paying less than what is in fact is being paid in that poor country to workers. So that's the argument. But that doesn't mean there are not other aspects of multinationals which we need to worry about. So I go on. I mean, I don't think there is Joan Robinson, my teacher, again, if I may cite her, used to say that in economics, everything and its opposite is true. And at some level, for you know, there's going to be some contrary evidence. Okay, I just don't think there is sufficient contrary evidence for any group of countries that I have looked at in the literature that I was reading, which suggests the kinds of adverse effects which you were pointing out in terms of what will happen, because there's a continuum of goods. Now, you're talking about the large guys bumping out, riding roughshod, you know, like a tank over these poor people. The continuum of goods which we discuss. I mean, when you in India, we stopped the large-scale sector from expanding precisely because of these kinds of worries that the little guys will be snuffed out. But what happened? I mean, when you say Unilever should not be allowed to produce more soap because the soap produced in the villages will be snuffed out. To call the two items soap is a bit of a, you know, a fantasy. I mean, what the villagers use is not something you're going to find in, you know, in the urban areas. I think a lot of elasticity of accommodation exists here. And what I worry about is that when we come to designing our policies, look, I'm totally with you, we don't want, you know, the kinds of effects you want. But I would rather look for governmental intervention which says, I'm going to stop all this globalization or large business or whatever from happening and creating the prosperity from which I can then earn incomes to be able to provide education and healthcare and so on. I would rather not do that simply assuming it's going to snuff out people, but simply say, let them expand. And if the little fellows begin to get crowded out or snuffed out, then I must be able to trigger a mechanism by which I come in with support. I think in many, the attitude you have, or rather the policy you seem to suggest, is that we should sort of slow down globalization because of some of these adverse effects can happen and maybe have happened, you see. So I think we have a slight difference in how we want to design, you know, worry about the downside, and also maybe a difference about whether the downsides are so big that they outweigh the plus sides.
I think he wants to move on.
We would I haven't got very far down the list of, you know, themes that I want to investigate further. But I do want time for questions, and we're into the last 15 minutes. So at this point, I am going to open it up to questions for Professor Bhagwati. If people could put their hands up, state who they are, where they're from, and keep the questions as fairly short questions rather than long statements, please, that would be great. Yes. There's a microphone on its way around.
Yes, my name's Wayne Green. I'm from Brighton in Sussex and a former student of Sussex University School of International Relations. And I have a small consultancy specializing in globalization. What I'm picturing from yourself and is globalization itself. You seem to pitch it in famous words, them or us. And what I'm particularly interested in is your simplification of globalization itself. You seem to think it's this force that has just come out of nowhere, this phenomenon in the last 20 years, where actually it seems to have its own philosophy in its own time and its own space. Where I would like to suggest that actually what we're seeing here is a deep social implicit structure, historic structure in this, it's crossed time, and also within this, which is not suggested, it is not economic, it is politically economic. They do not exist solely on their own.
Yes, I did not suggest anywhere there was this problem that the phenomenon arose in the last 20 years. I don't know how people have gotten that impression. I mean, the agitation against that has been about, you know, probably in recent years. Mm. But we've always had reactions against globalization. We've had movements against trade liberalization. You know, the tariff reform movements at the end of the 19th century in this country itself were all about reversing trade liberalization, going on to protectionism as Britain declined relative to US, or rather US and Japan came up. So we've had, I mean, one of the worries which people have who are for globalization is precisely that modern globalization depends not just on technological innovation with given policies, but on policy change itself, meaning additional liberalization which we've been carrying out politically Without politics, we would not have been able to carry out the liberal. So we have to understand why we went for what's sometimes called the liberal international order in the Western countries. We did go for that. So I'm not talking about that right now, but what I'm pointing out is that if one of the two principal ways in which modern globalization differs from the earlier ones is that it's driven by policy change as well, then it can be reversed as well, right? Mm. I mean, the technological side cannot be reversed, but the other one can be. So that is, I'm with you if that's what you're implying, that the politics is inherent in the process through policy formation.
Let's take some more questions. There's one right there.
Daniele Archibugi, Italian National Research Council, NLC. I mean, globalization is a highly contested word. Already 10 years ago, Paul Streeton collected about 60 different definitions. And I've seen recently in the literature a paper which has the title The Globalization of Nothing, another one which has The Globalization of Globalization, and soon there will be The Globalization of Globalization of Globalization, and so on. So, to a certain extent, I understand that in a period where many people argue against globalization, a book which has a title In Defense of Globalization, of course, is a very strong catchword, and so on. But to a certain extent, since it seems to me that, I mean, we already had books which were in defense of economic growth, for example, long ago, no? I think in the mid-70s. So, I mean, to a certain extent, I would like to see and to ask to the speakers to get their view on what can be done in order to contain the most damaging effects of globalization. For example, would both of you agree or disagree with the Tobin tax as a mean to prevent some of the most warning effects of financial speculations? Thank you.
Well, that's the attack position, right? I mean, appropriately named attack. But Tobin himself was against it, and why? Because you see, I mean, if your intention is to raise money, that's a different matter, okay? I mean, because there are many people who are coming to a Tobin tax saying that all these massive international transactions, put a little tiny tax on it, it'll generate massive revenues to spend on public good, right? There are all kinds of proposals of that kind, and books on that also. But that's not what you're talking about. I mean, it's really to prevent things like financial crises, right? I mean, that was the original intention of Professor Tobin, that the volatility of capital flows will be diminished as a result of this. I think it may be the volatility might be slightly diminished by taxing the frequent back and forth. But the real problem is things like the onset of big financial crises. At that time, a tiny tax is hardly anything people are going to worry about. I mean, if you think you've got to leave Malaysia and Thailand and Korea and so on, that's big money at stake, big payoffs, and a little Tobin tax will just be ignored. So in a way, it's not really something which, I mean, more or less for that reason, Tobin was against capital flows and volatility. So that's my answer.
Okay. Let's ask him. Let's
Professor come in.
And then.
No, that's implicit. I don't think it's a great idea.
I think that's an answer.
Okay,
so
just very quickly.
We'll
look, you raise a critical issue that is already raised by the first question. We're also dealing with the political process. Whether Tobin was for or against the Tobin tax, I would say at this point, is actually a secondary issue. Because what has happened is a politics of mobilizing around that tax. So Tobin may have disagreed with it, but in that sense, insofar as we need a certain kind of political, both a rhetoricizing of an issue, because that's part of the story, and Tobin tax right now is shorthand for a whole sort of agglomeration of issues, and we need the mobilization capabilities. I think we need a lot of different types of interventions. And one final point, all of these countries need finance. It's not that finance per se. So how do we get money to the poorer countries especially, right? The Tobin tax would be one mechanism, but the political issue goes further. It mobilizes citizens in rich countries around a project that is not totally unreasonable. So I am actually for it. We can continue discussing this later.
Why is that not surprising? Okay, there was one there, good.
Mukai, Jay Shah, LSE undergrad. I agree with you, Professor Bhagwati, that many countries such as India, China, Brazil, Mexico have a lot to gain from globalization. But you have to remember that there are numerous countries in sub-Saharan Africa which have kind of been left behind in globalization and don't seem to, I mean, you look at statistics on world trade, I think Africa contributes to something like 0.8% of, you know, share in world trade. What would you suggest are solutions to incorporating these countries back into the globalization arena, as you'd suggest? Thanks.
So what you're really saying is that globalization has passed these countries by. Globalization is only an opportunity, like a trade opportunity. Whether you will be able to access it sufficiently, you know, adequately, depends on preconditions like, you know, your governance, your infrastructure, and so on. So when I look at things like removal of agricultural subsidies, which is a big issue in the, you know, in the public domain, my worry is that if you really want to help Africa, the elasticity of supply from there is not going to be very high. And that in Keynes Group countries and, you know, the larger countries where they, which are better organized, have the skilled manpower to be able to penetrate markets, like, you know, get past the pesticide safety controls and so on. Without skilled manpower, which many of these countries don't have, they will not be able to even take advantage of these opening doors. So I think you need a whole slew of actions to be able to lift those, you know, the African countries out of their current sort of poverty. But this doesn't mean that somehow not opening those opportunities is a better alternative. You have to ask a question which I don't think economists can quite answer, but at least we can think about it. If you have bad governance, if you've got lack of all the preconditions for massive sort of for a elastic response to opportunities from the world economy, are you better off or worse off under open economy or a closed economy? And I would say on several, my priors, the open you are, the more likely it is that the winds of change will come in. The mere fact that an opportunity exists might be able to galvanize some of your governments into doing the things to exploit the opportunity. This is a Hirschman idea of a creative disequilibrium and so on. So as I said, it's not an economist answer, it's just an intellectual answer. And I would vote for openness rather than closeness.
Yeah, I would not close up and protect a bad government either. But one qualifier on what you said, see, I think Africa has been bypassed only in some sense, sub-Saharan Africa. But it has not been bypassed by part of the international apparatus that has developed around questions of globalization, which is, of course, the IMF, the World Bank. Sub-Saharan Africa has been a key playground, actually, to try out a whole variety of structural adjustment programs, etc., in those countries. And we have 20 years of evidence, you know, a whole slew of countries and then a whole slew of other countries for the 90s. And in that sense, I would say, Jagdish, that globalization has articulated with Africa, but not on the economics, etc. And then finally, on the trade issue, since this is crucial in the book, I mean, the 40,000 coffee growers who are part of fair trade, it's great for them, globalization, but they are protected by a set of, you know, fair trade issues. And one of the questions for sub-Saharan Africa is that there is not so much free trade because of the subsidy structures in agriculture, etc., etc. So that I think, for instance, that if we really had free trade could be a force for good distributive effects. Trade is inherently far more democratic than global finance.
So what you're saying is that you should have freer trade. You're not opposing
me. What I'm saying is that openness in sub-Saharan Africa has meant, ironically, that all the protections, the subsidies of the U.S., since agriculture is crucial for that part of the world, and the European Union have had, you know, a lot of playing ground, so
but
to
you
say.
But you see, if you take the least developed...
So you cannot just say openness.
No, if you take the least developed countries, the 49, the way they're defined, of which,
yes,
42 are net importers of agricultural goods, therefore, if you were going to remove the agricultural subsidies here and raise world prices, I would just ask you, is this going to hurt or help these countries? I mean, those are the kinds of questions you have to analyze. And, you know,
sure.
And generally, and also if you're getting something cheaper, you might as well, that's an advantage to you. And then you may have support schemes to use that money to help the people who, you know, who have to adjust and so on. But the, all these complexities which we deal with,
but also these very
in the classrooms, you know. But the point is, the trade opportunity itself is a very, very useful thing for these people to have.
Well, I think trade opportunity.
I'm going to try and squeeze in two more. The forest of hands is growing, but there's a red one up there. It's yours. We're going to finish at 1:45 sharp, so people can move along.
Sumer Junaid, Government and Economics at the LSE. Professor Bhagwati, I just want to ask you, when you said globalization should be slow so that the adverse impacts are not felt, not mass unemployment, the inefficient firms suddenly don't...
The transition.
Yeah, transition should be slow. But going back to the politics of economics, don't you think with all the political pressure from the West, from the EU, and also a lot of the financial loans being subject to reform and opening up to trade, does not give the developing world that option?
No, I think the pressure comes from the diffusion of ideas, mainly, in my opinion. I mean, a lot, like India has been opening up recently. I mean, not because anybody put pressure on it. Gorbachev went into perestroika not because of pressure, because he and Shevardnadze decided finally it was time to call it quits. I mean, you know, they're just going to go on like that. So actually, I mean, you know, I have a whole book on going, what's called Going Alone, where it's really your own internal realization that, you know, you're shooting yourself in the foot with very high tariff protection, etc., which really, you know, drives a whole lot of liberalization. There is pressure when you're negotiating, of course, at the WTO, for example, because everybody's trying to do something, so you've got to do something too. Otherwise, you know, you sort of don't get the kinds of concessions you want for your own exports. So there are pressures. If you look at the bank and fund conditionality, again, they live in the real world. Once they've started giving money, they're not able to impose their conditionality in quite the way which, say, Professor Stiglitz makes out in his book. One of my students looked at even IMF conditionality, which is much narrower, you know, M1, M2, M3, and stuff like that. There too, the book is, you know, his dissertation is called Policy Reversals. A lot of policies get reversed while IMF continues. Because, you know, once you're in, you also get attached to, I mean, you want to make it a success. Mm-hmm. And the bigger countries also know how to play the game of, you know, getting around conditionality. So it's a much more complicated thing, true, for the very small countries which become protectorates, basically, or owned by the IMF or the U.S. Treasury or by the Dutch government, I don't know. I mean, you know, those are things which you will get occasional examples, but conditionality, I don't think, is the main driving force for what has been happening in recent years, where a number of developing countries decided that they were, you know, they really had been going in the wrong direction. You know, Galbraith once said of Milton Friedman, you know, that his tragedy is that his meaning Milton Friedman's tragedy is that his policies were tried. And we've had autarky, we've had inward looking, we've had all the policies against globalization, and people found or felt, the policymakers felt, that it wasn't working. Therefore, they changed. Now the battle is about whether the pendulum will swing back again, and that's really the way to think about it, in my opinion. But most people have come away, and all the polls have to be taken, it depends on how you ask the questions. And, you know, when you said, are you for globalization, do you think it's, God knows what the respondent is thinking, right? I mean, there are how many concepts of globalization? But even within economic globalization, which part of it are you talking about? Financial flows, trade, whatever. Yeah. But all the polls show that in the developing countries, there's a much more favorable response to globalization than in the developed countries. And that has to do with this reversal, that they were autarkic and so on. They want to try a different model. At our end, we were for liberalization, and all the worries have come to this side of the street. The big countries are afraid of the small countries. In Prebisch's time, the small countries are afraid of the big countries. That's how life is. So the battles change. The war continues.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to have to draw it to a close there. Sorry, there are many, many hands left up, but we're on time. Let me thank... Let me thank both the participants, as you have. Obviously, Professor Bhagwati brings great clarity to these issues. The debate will go on. The book outside is a very valuable contribution to your understanding of it. Thank you again.
Thank you, Tony. Very good questions.